famine. Last month brought another troubling milestone. The UN announced that the absolute number of people without enough food, which had been going down for years, actually went up to 815 million.
If we don't do a lot more, then this goal of ending hunger will not be met, not even close.
Voss is hoping this accumulation of evidence will prompt action, like more investments to help small farms. Nurit Eisenman, NPR News.
This is West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Support is provided by the West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit WVDRS.org. And by Edith's Health and Specialty Store in downtown Lewisburg, featuring health food, supplements, body care, and more since 1986. Details on Facebook at Edith's Store. Coming up next, it's West Virginia Morning. It's 7:41 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. For many people in rural areas, transit is a lifeline, especially for those dealing with a disability.
You know, it opens your eyes. If you don't have something like that, you can't do your job, or you can't go to your doctor, you can't get groceries, you can't do anything.
But transit funding is not keeping pace with growing demand. That story from the Ohio Valley Resources just ahead. But first, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. More than a dozen people have been killed in Afghanistan today in a series of attacks blamed on the Taliban. South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, is once again reshuffling his cabinet. Peter Granitz reports from Pretoria.
Zuma's moves affect five government ministries. He fired the Minister of Higher Education, who was seen as the most vocal critic in the cabinet of Zuma's corruption. That minister, Blaise Nzimande, leads the South African Communist Party. Zuma's party, the African National Congress, relies on the communists for votes, but the firing could cause them to break the alliance.
Last week, South Africa's highest appeals court reinstated hundreds of corruption charges against Zuma. Baseball, the New York Yankees are climbing back into the American League Championship Series. Last night, the Yankees beat the Houston Astros 8-1 to cut the Astros' lead in the series to 2-1. The Yankees got a pair of three-run homers, one from Aaron Judge and the other from third baseman Todd Frazier, who describes it as
very exciting. We knew we needed this one, and I'm just glad I can kickstart us in that, you know, second inning and get us going there up 3-0. That's a big lead.
Game four is tonight in New York. In the National League, the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Chicago Cubs square off tonight in Game 3 of the National League Championship Series. The Dodgers lead 2-0. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Farmers Insurance, committed to making the world a smarter place through shared knowledge and experience. Tales of home, car, and other insurance coverage can be found at farmers.com. From Trader Joe's, where customers will find pumpkin products throughout the fall. Items like pumpkin JoJo's, pumpkin pancakes, and pumpkins themselves are available. More at TraderJoe's.com and at Trader Joe's on Instagram. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation at gatesfoundation.org.
This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Shepherd University hosted an event yesterday exploring the possibilities of more efficient ways for universities, industry, government, and scientific researchers to work together to combat the opioid epidemic. And as Liz McCormick reports, a recent public opinion survey indicates West Virginians want to see the state be a leader on this issue.
The survey, conducted by Research America in partnership with Zogby Analytics, was presented at Shepherd's event, West Virginia Research and Innovation, a catalyst for better health and economic growth. The two-hour event focused on ways the state's universities can partner with companies, researchers, and other professionals to effectively address the state's overwhelming opioid crisis. Several speakers, including Shepherd University President Mary Hendricks, pointed out how investing in education is the key to making real real headway in the epidemic. She also pointed to partnerships between universities and big research companies like the data and analytic giant Elsevier. Brad Fenwick is the senior vice president for global strategic alliances with Elsevier. He argues partnerships between universities and companies like his can make a big difference when dealing with complex issues like the opioid epidemic.
Those partnerships, by having the intelligence and the time to think about those type of things, and then and the support from government, and then the ability to apply that knowledge through industry, just our experience makes things happen, as opposed to any one of those bits of the triple helix doing it on their own.
President and CEO of Research America, Mary Woolley, says the survey her nonprofit conducted found West Virginians lead the nation in wanting to see more health research, and that they think it's a wise investment of tax dollars.
West Virginians are even more sure that we've got to make more progress faster and use resources to get there. I think that's probably because West Virginians are living up close and personal with very tough health challenges right now.
Some of the research showed that 70% of West Virginians strongly agree opioids are being overprescribed and creating a barrier to combating the epidemic. And 43% want to see more federal funding for STEM education. 47% strongly support more funding for research to understand and treat addiction. But only 27% strongly support the use of overdose-reversing drugs like Narcan. Senators Joe Manchin and Shelley Moore Capito also attended the event. Both encouraged West Virginians to reach out to them and say what's working on the federal level and what isn't when dealing with the opioid crisis. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
Many of President Donald Trump's supporters strongly distrust news media. With that in mind, journalists with PolitiFact, a political fact-checking website, are visiting places that supported Trump the most, hoping to foster conversations. An event will be hosted tonight at the Kanawha County Public Library, wrapping up 2 days of meetings in the state with political leaders and residents. Dave Mistich spoke with PolitiFact senior correspondent Lewis Jacobson.
So Tuesday's forum in Charleston is the third and final stop on this mini tour for PolitiFact. You all have stopped in Mobile, Alabama and Tulsa, Oklahoma. These places, like Charleston, were picked specifically for their heavy support of Donald Trump. I should mention that a Rasmussen poll in September of last year, towards the very end of the campaign season, showed that 88% of Trump supporters don't believe fact-checking organizations such as yours. Tell us a little bit about making these choices for the locations of these events and what you all have seen so far.
Sure. Well, I'm glad you cited that figure, because that was really kind of a motivating factor for us in deciding to do this. We got a little bit of grant money from the Knight Foundation, which funds journalism projects. And, you know, as a fact-checking organization, we want to get factual, trustworthy information out there. And it's kind of depressing and disturbing for us if a large chunk of the country just doesn't want to hear what we have to say. So we'd like to kind of bridge the divide with these trips. And these are, you know, three solidly red states. You know, I think a big motivation for me in wanting to do this is to sort of reach out to people who might not even know that we exist, or if they do know that we exist, to try to get them to trust us more. And that can really only be done on a face-to-face basis. So much of the political discourse today is totally online, often anonymous. People are tempted and are able to throw darts at each other without seeing them in person. And so we have set up meetings. We just finished one with a bunch of GOP officials here in Morgantown, about a half dozen people, as a sort of a freewheeling conversation about their concerns on the media, about us in particular, but also just in general the media and what they do and don't like, and ways that we can sort of, you know, address their concerns.
You know, I think it's safe to say that a lot of this conversation comes down to a wider distrust in the news media. I should mention a recent Gallup poll shows trust in the media remains extremely low, and a lot of people might argue that President Trump, his cries of fake news, plays some role in that. But, you know, in the same breath, we should also point out that Gallup's polling numbers put his approval rating hovering somewhere under about, you know, 40% or so. How big of a factor is Trump's rhetoric and the media criticism playing into all this, with his approval rating being so low? Is there any explanation for that at all?
It's a fair question. I don't really know the answer to that, but I will say that I think what the president has done with his rhetoric is he's really bolstered his own supporters in a sort of anti-media frame of mind, but also at the same time bolstered his opponents in more of a pro-media frame of mind. And unfortunately, it breaks down. It further sort of divides us between those who trust the media and those who don't. And I see that as unfortunate, and I think that's part of what we're trying to do here during our visit. We want people to have open minds and to be open to new arguments and factual arguments, factual data, and not just simply brush it off as being, untrustworthy without even giving a chance. And we want to sort of reach out to people, as we've been doing on this trip, who might not necessarily follow us currently or might be predisposed against us, and try to present ourselves as, real people who are trying our best to sort of navigate a difficult challenge in finding what's true and try to sort of get people to give us a shot.
And I want to wrap things up by, saying that knowing all of this and with the news media being hyper aware of this climate, we here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting are aware. The other news outlets in the state and across the country are also very aware of this. With Trump in office, the public's perception of the media, all of that, what is the answer, if anything? It seems like reporters are going to great lengths to be transparent in their reporting methods, their sourcing of documents, of any sort of materials that make their way into the reporting, vetting of sources, interviews, all of that. We also saw a big push from the New York Times to make the reporting staff more self-aware in how they're using social media. They set guidelines and even opened that up to the public to see to what lengths they're going. Is all of this a step forward? If so, if not, either way, what else needs to be done?
Sure. I think several of those steps are wise steps. I do like the idea of journalists on social media trying to avoid very opinionated statements. That's probably a smart decision. I totally like the idea of transparency of sources. I mean, as I said, we at PolitiFact try to be very transparent about that. In terms of listing all our sources and not using off-the-record comments or like anonymous comments from sources. I think ultimately, while journalists and journalism in general can do useful things like that, small steps, I think over the longer term, it actually comes down to the education system and sort of making sure that young kids growing up today are sort of open-minded, intellectually curious, and know how to navigate the World Wide Web in a way that they can know what is questionable information and what is trustworthy. It's really kind of an issue that our K through 12 and even college education systems need to start focusing on, so that kids have the tools that they need to figure out what is true and what is not in what's kind of currently a wild west of the internet.
All right, Lou. Well, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Dave Mistich speaking with PolitiFact senior correspondent Lewis Jacobson about the Outwood stop in Charleston tonight at the Kanawha County Public Library. For more of that conversation, visit us online at wvpublic.org. The Ohio Valley region has a disproportionately high number of seniors and people living with disabilities and on low incomes. Those are all groups that frequently depend on public transit. Without transit, older people lose independence, and reaching a doctor or workplace becomes much harder. A new report finds that demand for transit in rural areas is climbing faster than in cities. But as Becca Schimmel reports, spending on rural transit is not keeping pace with demand.
Thelma Dalton is headed to the salon to get her hair done like she does every Friday. She gets picked up at her house and greeted by one of the many familiar faces with the Rural Transit Enterprises, or RTEC.
Are you Miss Dalton?
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing just fine.
Dalton is 95 years old and has been riding the public transit system in Somerset, Kentucky for 15 years. The salon is in what looks like a small white house only a local would know about. Dalton says her daughter would like for her to move, but Dalton says she likes her community and has no intention of leaving.
And I want to stay here. I want to be in my own home if I can as long as I live.
Dalton is just one of many seniors in small towns and rural areas who want to age in place and remain connected to their community. But the RTEC is not just the only transit system in Somerset, it's also the only one for the 12 surrounding counties. Mary Denny has been driving for RTEC for 5 years. She says people in her community would be stranded or homebound without the service, not just seniors.
And it doesn't just pertain to just elderly. We have anywhere from young individuals that's struggling, you know, low income, that's just struggling to make ends meet, that we're able to help and assist.
Compared to national averages, the Ohio Valley has a higher percentage of senior citizens, people with disabilities, and people living on low incomes, all groups likely to depend on transit. It can make it possible to keep a job, reach a doctor, or just get your hair done. But transit experts in the region worry that funding is not keeping pace with demand.
We have to do something, because if we don't do something, we fall farther and farther behind.
That's Juva Barber with Kentuckians for Better Transportation. She says by 2020, Kentucky will need $10 million from the general fund to keep services as they are now, not including any improvements.
When you're looking for a workforce, if that workforce can't get there, that puts you farther down on the list when it comes to site selection. So that impacts economic development.
Charles Rutkowski is with Community Transportation Association of America. He says every patient, customer, and student represents income, revenue, and economic development for that healthcare institution or college. He adds, for every dollar that's invested in transit, there's a benefit of $3.50 to that community.
It provides jobs, but it also transports a lot of local folks to jobs. And some of those individuals probably could not access those jobs were it not for the existence of public transit.
Rutkowski says public transportation can help lower-income individuals break out of the cycle of poverty. And if seniors like Ms. Dalton can stay in their homes, that costs less than an assisted living facility. Kurt Conrad is the CEO of Stark Area Regional Transit Authority in Canton, Ohio.
Every 2 years, we have to go back to the General Assembly and set those funding marks. We have no guaranteed funding sources for transit at the state level.
Conrad says the state has supported the public transit system, but the needs are outgrowing what has historically been provided. He says they also transport about 170,000 people a year that qualify for public assistance under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Without us, those 170,000 people would be homebound.
Bowling Green, Kentucky resident Scott Henry never expected to need a service like that.
You know, being a healthy person all my life, and I never, ever thought I'd be in a situation where I'd have to count on paratransit transportation to get back and forth to work every day.
But about a year ago, Henry's knee collapsed, became infected, and he wasn't able to get a knee replacement. He's been unable to drive since.
You know, it opens your eyes. If you don't have something like that, you can't do your job or you can't go to your doctor. You can't get groceries. You can't do anything. And living alone, I had no one to help me.
Henry says arranging private transportation can cost about $200 a day. He's had to cancel doctor's appointments and even surgeries because he couldn't get a vehicle to get him to the hospital. Then he learned he was in the right area to use the city's transit, BG Go. That gave him some motivation.
So when I got that spark, then it was like, I was going to do this today. I was going to do that today. I was going to get up today. I was going to do this by myself today. I was going to get dressed today. I was going to get dressed like I was going to work today. And so that really did it. Without this, I couldn't be here today.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource.